This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Superheroes, Capes, Cowls, and the Creation of Comic Book Culture by Lawrence Maslin. Based on the documentary film by Michael Cantor. Read for you by Lawrence Maslin.
Introduction. Writer's Rostrum. Hey there, apostles of adventure. Everyone has a favorite superhero. Whether you first fell in love with Tobey Maguire's Peter Parker or Steve Ditko's original version, no matter how you got there, it's a good bet that your first encounter with a superhero made your heart soar a little higher, your life a little more colorful, your dreams a little bolder. It could be that you were still in your PJs one Saturday morning and glimpsed your first superhero on TV. Or maybe he burst forth in full Dolby surround sound in the darkened hush of a multiplex. Or it could be that you're one of those young upstarts who are digging your superheroes on those newfangled devices, zooming from panel to panel by swiping your fingers across a screen. But if you've picked up a copy of this book, the odds are good that you've also picked up a comic book at some point in your life. And you probably remember the first time a four-color superhero comic book caught your eye. Maybe it was on a spinning rack on the counter of your friendly neighborhood candy store. Maybe it was lent to you by a pal in the bunk above yours at summer camp. Perhaps your mom bought it for you in the supermarket, or perhaps you stumbled into a local comic book shop and gasped at the wide array of do-gooders and crime fighters spread out on the shelves against the wall. Still, it's hard to believe that superheroes have only been a part of the American culture for three-quarters of a century. This companion volume complements our three-hour PBS documentary series, Superheroes: A Never-Ending Battle. Most of the time, that battle is between the forces of good and the purveyors of evil. But the battle extends into the conflict between art versus commerce, expression versus repression, tradition versus progress. This book allows us a little more room to investigate and explore the legends of the superheroes and their astonishing cultural impact. Some caveats. If you're a comic book fan, we can guarantee right up front that one of your favorite characters, or titles, or storylines hasn't made it into the book. Unlike the comic book universe, space and scope are not infinite here. But if it makes you feel any better, a lot of our favorites were canceled, too. Also, the dating of actual comic books is complicated. The cover date on any given comic book is not an accurate representation of when the comic met the public. For bizarre reasons of distribution and accounting, a cover date may register anywhere from 2 to 4 months ahead of when readers could buy the issue. When it's important for historical context to explain when a comic book hit the stands, we do so. At other times, we refer to the official cover date. The backbone of both the documentary series and the companion volume are the more than 50 interviews conducted with the best and brightest pioneers in the field of the comic book industry. That said, we have to give an honorary Super Team membership card to four extraordinary gentlemen: Joe Simon, Jerry Robinson, Joe Kubert, and Carmine Infantino. Sad to say, they each passed away between the time of their interviews and the completion of this project. It is doubtful that any one of them courted posterity when they got into the embryonic comic book business, but they have certainly earned the respect and admiration of millions of Americans since. So, turn the page. We've got thrills, chills, and spills awaiting you. The world of superheroes is full of constantly shifting dynamics and dynamic duos. But here's one thing we can promise you. After reading and watching Superheroes: A Never-Ending Battle, no mom will ever dare to throw out her kid's comic book collection again. Onward and upward! Literate Larry Maslon and movie man Michael Cantor. Part 1. Truth, Justice, and the American Way. 1938 to 1954. In the middle of the Great Depression, everything in America seemed rendered in black and white. It was a drab, colorless world, one with stark contrasts. You were either lucky to have a job, or, like one quarter of the workforce, you went begging for one. You were either one of the privileged few, or you were scrambling simply to survive. Opportunity was also painted with a brush dipped in India ink. Your family could either afford to send you to college, or they couldn't. If you were sent to an influential Ivy League school, you were one of the accepted crowd, or you were an outsider, restricted from the inner circle because of your background. If you were a woman, you stayed at home, or if necessary, you got a job. If you were lucky enough to find one, you earned half of a man's salary. In the South, if you were white, you got to vote and move freely in society. If you were black, neither option was available to you. Harsh reality came in monochrome. Men wore dark suits and white shirts. Women wore dresses in a narrow color range from blue to brown. City apartments were painted in dark green or dull cream and crammed with heavy, dark mahogany furniture. Newspapers were printed in black and white, and so were the interior pages of all books and magazines. Theater programs had none of the spectacular hues to be seen on stage. Photographs were black and white. Movies, which had only recently begun to speak, came in only one variety. There were exceptions, of course, little flashes of color to catch the eye. Postage stamps had the faint tint of pink or green. Your mother's kitchen might have a red and blue canister of Calumet baking powder or a box of Quaker white oats. If your dad sent you to the corner candy store or newsstand to buy his pack of Lucky Strikes with its red bullseye, you might be tempted by the colorful wrapper of a Baby Ruth or the label on a Coca-Cola bottle. The magazine covers that peeked over the racks, the Saturday Evening Post or Modern Screen, or if you were an urban kid, the New Yorker, entice the buyer with splashes of color. If you wanted to indulge in a rainbow explosion of color, however, you had only one option, the Sunday Funnies. If you pried the pages away from your father or your older brother, you could dive headfirst into the adventures of various detectives, spacemen, errant children, hillbillies, strangely proportioned sailors, and a host of other colorful characters. Every major paper across the country had a Sunday section in color, perhaps as a fantastical reward for kids who had to be on their best behavior in church that morning. Yet the funnies were meant to be shared with the family. They were never meant to be collected or saved as a child's private property. So imagine going to that corner drugstore or newsstand for your dad's cigarettes or your own candy bar in the middle of April 1938. The dozen different black and white newspapers are filled with news about Germany's annexation of Austria and the Chicago Blackhawks winning the Stanley Cup. Somewhere on that drugstore counter is a spinning rack of 10-cent comic magazines. They were occasionally diverting, but usually filled with reprints from the comic strip pages. This week, there is something different. The debut of a new title, Action Comics Number 1. On its blazing full-color cover, a well-muscled man in blue leotards and a flowing red cape is hoisting a green car over his head. The entire green car. And when did you ever see a green car? This impossible strongman has an S on his chest, but otherwise is completely unidentified on the cover, and certainly there was no warning that he is coming your way. On the bottom left-hand corner of the cover, a man is running toward you, eyes bugging out, head and hands completely traumatized. This poor fellow had never seen anything like this red and blue phenomenon before. No one had. It was the beginning of an explosion that would color American culture for decades to come. Chapter 1. Next week, Into the Jaws of Death. Evolution of the Superhero. In the beginning, the comic strips. There were two kinds of superstars on the funny pages, the colorful characters whose names were emblazoned at the top of the strip, and their creators whose names were slugged next to them in bold letters nearly as large. Comic strips had become an American institution a few years into the 20th century. The early efforts varied in size, format, and quality, exemplified by Winsor McCay's Little Nemo in Slumberland, with its idiosyncratic look and exotic appeal. The comic strips were always packaged into a discrete section, popularly known as the funny papers, or the funnies. The early funnies were exactly that, humorous digressions into American life, usually rendered through the antics of misbehaved children, gently embattled families, mismatched friends, or communities thrown into conflict by a variety of implacable or goofy characters. They were a gentle funhouse mirror of American life, and soon evolved from reflecting the American way of life to becoming an indelible part of it. As the popularity of the funnies grew, so did the money to be made from them. Cartoonists routinely submitted their work to national syndicates, who edited, refined, and packaged the strips, then leased them to papers around the country. By 1927, the 40 million newspapers circulated across the nation contained more than 2,000 different syndicated features. The vast preponderance of these features was comic strips. In an age when radio was just beginning to extend its vast empire of the air, the daily newspaper strip was a powerful way of connecting with readers, young and old, and not just connecting with them on a visceral level, but on a serial level. The appeal of continuity cannot be overestimated. Comic strips hooked readers on a daily basis in an unprecedented way. Aside from the most absurdist strips, or one-panel features, most comic strips developed some kind of narrative thread by the mid-1920s. The phrase, "to be continued," supposedly was coined in 1903 for a comic strip. Newspapers quickly caught on to this benign addiction. The best-endowed papers leased the most popular strips from the most powerful syndicates, such as the Chicago Tribune New York News Syndicate, the United Features Syndicate. Woe betide the young fan of Popeye or Blondie, whose father's politics veered to the liberal New York Herald Tribune. Their escapades were only syndicated in the Journal American, a Hearst newspaper with conservative political values. By the mid-1920s, a new kind of feature was added to the daily paper, an innovation whose power exploded exponentially every Sunday in the full-color sections, the adventure strip. Adventure strips were far more serious in nature and followed some sort of dashing hero, and often his cohorts, who used both might and main, as well as wits, to escape various hazards and perils. Perhaps these strips were inspired by the various real-life heroes, such as Charles Lindbergh, Babe Ruth, and Jack Dempsey, whose exploits were being celebrated in the front and back pages of the newspaper. Perhaps they were the logical extension of the taste for heroic fiction that emerged after the war, such as Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan of the Apes, or Johnston McCulley's serial, The Curse of Capistrano, which featured the swashbuckling Zorro. Perhaps readers had simply gotten weary of the pranks and silliness of most comic strips. It hardly mattered. The stage was set in 1924 when Harold Gray's Little Orphan Annie found herself in harm's way for the first, but not last, time, and Roy Crane's bumptious feature Wash Tubbs introduced a soldier of fortune named Captain Easy, who quickly hijacked the strip and by the end of the 1920s, commandeered the Sunday spread. In a seemingly impossible coincidence, although maybe not so improbable in a comic strip, two groundbreaking adventure strips debuted on the same day, January 7th, 1929. Buck Rogers, a crudely drawn space opera, was repurposed from the pulp fiction adventures about a World War I veteran who was caught in suspended animation and awakened in the 25th century. Although the outer space antics of Buck and company were to be widely imitated, the more influential strip that landed on the kitchen table with a thump on that cold Monday was Tarzan, consummately drawn by Hal Foster, who, after a brief respite in 1930, continued with the strip until 1937. Transplanting the resourceful ape man from his fictional roots to the graphically exciting world of the comic strip proved to be a natural transition and set a high water mark for the genre. In 1934, two other cornerstones of adventure strips appeared. Alex Raymond achieved one of the most astonishing trifectas in comics history when, within 2 weeks in January, he debuted three separate narrative comic features. The spy strip Secret Agent X-9, scripted by, of all people, Dashiell Hammett. Jungle Jim, who buckled his swash, unsurprisingly, in the jungle. And perhaps the most ambitious of all strips, Flash Gordon, about a rugged blonde adventurer who must endure the ultimate alienation effect when he's sent to the planet Mongo to fend off the imperialist mischief of Ming the Merciless. For fans of more down-to-earth adventures, there was the ultimate soldier of fortune narrative, Terry and the Pirates. Created by artist Milton Caniff and drawn in a unique and influential graphic style, the series chronicled a band of heroes across the Eastern Hemisphere. Tarzan, Flash Gordon, and Terry and the Pirates offered comic strip art at its most sophisticated. But Chester Gould's often coarse renditions of violent gunplay in Dick Tracy, which debuted in 1931 at the height of America's internecine gangland warfare, showed that crime-fighting could pay as well. Perhaps more effective than the strip's relentless, razor-nosed, eponymous detective were the dozens of bizarre, disfigured villains he pursued in the strip, each with an outward manifestation of some corrupt and criminal soul. Other popular and influential strips at the time were The Phantom, 1936, the first adventurer to kick around in tights and a mask, which magically erased his pupils, and of course, Popeye, who debuted as a featured character in another strip in the late 1920s. The rough and tumble sailor man played more as comedy than adventure, but certainly captured young readers' attentions with his feats of super strength, originally derived by rubbing himself with a magic hen. The men who created these vibrant characters, often in collaboration with clever editors, were usually trained artists who had attended prestigious art schools. Several even had college degrees. They also had a brush or two in the magazine and advertising illustration worlds, which, in an age before color photography in magazines, was a respected and lucrative profession. Devoting your entire life to conceiving, drawing, and inking comic strips, which essentially was a job description, was not exactly the stuff of their childhood dreams. In fact, Hal Foster took on the Tarzan assignment as a stopgap in his advertising career. He eventually became intrigued enough with comics to return to Tarzan and to create the medieval adventures of Prince Valiant, which were rendered in some of the most handsome and intricate panoramas in comic strip history. Comic strip creators such as Foster, Raymond, Kniff, and Gould became personalities in their own right, featured prominently in newspaper articles, advertisements, and newsreels. Alex Raymond had always been an idol of mine, remembers comic book artist Joe Kubert. One day, in the late 1930s, Kubert and a high school chum called Raymond out of the blue and asked if they could interview him for the high school newspaper. Raymond invited them up to his tree-lined estate in Tony Stanford, Connecticut.
And his valet, I guess, answered the door. I mean, this was a dream for us. Answered the door and let us in, and he leads us to Alex Raymond's studio. In the middle of the studio is this big Great Dane laying on an oval rug in the middle of the place. He's got this beautiful tape. Now, I'm coming from Brooklyn, from East New York. And I come into this place, and Norm and I, we were just struck dumb by what we saw. We couldn't say a word. We walk into his studio. He's got one full wall, all glass, where you can see the woods. I can still recall it. Books lining all the other walls, shelves of all the stuff that he's done. He was so kind. Now, he must have had all kinds of deadlines on work that he was doing. Took out 3 or 4 hours. We were so nervous, we didn't even sit down. We just talked and talked and talked, and he answered all our questions with the utmost of kindness.
With lucrative syndicate contracts, endorsements, licensing, and so on, artists such as Raymond could become millionaires smack in the middle of the Depression. And the characters they created grew to have lives of their own, first in the hearts of young and old throughout the country, then on the radio, where many of them appeared in their own highly rated programs, in animated cartoons that often added to their legendary mythos. This is where Popeye traded in his magic hen for some spinach, and even in early movie serials. These daily adventurers had the power to infiltrate the national consciousness on the most popular level, and a mighty power it was, too. However modest the roots of the comic strip, and whatever aversions these illustrators might have had to the daily grind, they eventually understood and embraced the creative freedom of the comics. As Alex Raymond put it, "I decided that comic art is an art form in itself. It reflects life and times more accurately and is more artistic than magazine illustration, since it is entirely creative. An illustrator works with cameras and models. A comic artist begins with a white sheet of paper and dreams up the whole business. He is playwright, director, editor, and artist at once." Crime does not pay. The Bloody Pulps. In many ways, the modern superhero owes his lineage to a strange interlude between a venerable tradition of heroic fiction and the new technology of the radio. The appeal of adventure heroes and serialized fiction became obvious as early as 1844, when Alexandre Dumas released the escapades of his Three Musketeers and D'Artagnan in consecutive newspaper installments. Sherlock Holmes appeared before the British public in various magazine publications long before his adventures were collected in various hardcover anthologies. In America, the taste for quickly disposable adventure tales, pitched largely to a young male audience, found an enduring repository in Argosy magazine, a cheaply printed monthly omnibus of tales. By 1896, Argosy had morphed into a successful format. It was joined by The All Story in 1905, and between the two publications and their various incarnations, memorable characters such as Tarzan, John Carter of Mars, She Who Must Be Obeyed, and Zorro were given a launching pad to meet the American public. These repositories of popular fiction could be found every month on every newsstand. Each magazine cost the reader only one thin dime, which accounted for the cheap, pulpy paper on which they were printed. The pulps, as they were popularly called, diversified after World War I, reaching out to selected readers enticed by, say, science fiction in amazing stories, horror stories in weird tales, which raised the curtain on Conan the Barbarian, aviation tales in Flying Aces, detective stories in Detective Story, or even more appealing detective stories in Spicy Detective Stories. In the decades before the advent of the paperback novel, these pulps filled an impressive niche for the reading public. In its heyday of the mid-1930s, the publisher Street and Smith Publications, one of the leaders in the field, sold millions of copies of various titles per month. At the beginning of the Depression, Street and Smith would make an unprecedented commercial decision, one that would bring the world of heroic adventures to its widest audience yet. The publishers were based in New York City, the media capital of the world, so it seemed only natural for them to turn to the radio studio in order to promote their product. In an early example of synergy, the Detective Story Hour, a series of mystery dramas designed to promote the anthology detective magazine, debuted in the summer of 1930. Most radio shows needed some kind of host to organize the proceedings for listeners, so Detective Story Hour had a mysterious MC known only as The Shadow. If Street and Smith expected their penumbral host to sell magazines, The Shadow's haunting laugh was on them. Listeners begged for a new magazine that featured The Shadow, while Detective Story's press run dwindled. To their credit, the pulp publishers responded reasonably quickly to the demand, and the following spring, one of the greatest characters in popular culture emerged in his very own magazine. Night. Flattened high on the wall, a motionless, bat-like shadow. Slowly the shadow begins moving its huge wings outspread in specter-like form. Suddenly, the staccato cracking of mobster guns, but high above, in the cool night air, rings a peal of laughter. The triumph laugh of the Master of Darkness, the Shadow. Thus does the Shadow go forth to battle crime, to vanquish his foes of the underworld and make justice triumph. Crime does not pay. The Shadow knows. The Shadow's adventures were ground out by a hardy soul named Walter B. Gibson, who was also an accomplished magician. Some of that magic was sorely needed, as Maxwell Grant, Gibson's de rigueur pseudonym, was responsible for two entire Shadow novels a month, an assignment that required approximately 140,000 words. Luckily, Gibson, who would eventually write 282 of The Shadow's 325 pulp appearances, adjusted himself to the task with ingenuity. He placed a series of Remington typewriters in various rooms around his country house, just so he could type a sentence or two whenever the mood struck. Whether or not there was a typewriter in the bathroom is lost to history. The pulp version of The Shadow proved to be enormously resilient, popular, and yet endearingly hard to know. Perhaps that's why he was also referred to as the Master of Darkness. clad in a black slouch hat with a billowing red-lined cloak, the Shadow would dispense justice to evildoers without so much as judge or jury. He battles crime with thrills and chills and smoking automatics, read one concise advertisement. He had a secret identity which was constantly shifting. Apparently, he was a World War I flying ace named Kent Allard. When he was in New York City, the Shadow also bartered for the identity of Lamont Cranston, a wealthy playboy. Frequently, as a master of disguise, he took on a range of other personalities. The Shadow also used a variety of operatives, and worked within the boundaries of the law when it suited him. He had an arsenal of weapons, including an early auto gyro, a grappling hook, suction cups, and a mysterious ring that hypnotized interlopers. Although he took the occasional jaunt to the Far East, which seemed to hold the monopoly on both international mischief makers and the go-to destination for the acquisition of superpowers, the Shadow toiled within the warehouses, docks, opium dens, and Art Deco skyscrapers of Manhattan. With his beaky face, swarthy brow, and magnetic eyes, the Shadow was hardly an all-American ideal in any event. The Shadow became a breakout character for Street and Smith. By 1937, they yanked the anonymous host of the radio broadcast and created a new program, tailor-made to fit their pulp character. The Shadow's sepulchral voice now emanated from the Mutual Broadcast Network in his own weekly series, initially impersonated by none other than Orson Welles, which became a mainstay of radio drama for two decades. On the airwaves, the Shadow was given some new, mutually exclusive powers from his print counterpart. He now had the ability to cloud men's minds so that they could not see him. A regular girlfriend named Margot Lane, and the more regular identity of Lamont Cranston, a wealthy young man about town. And if his maniacal laugh was still present in both media, the Shadow refrained from blowing evildoers away on the radio. If fans of the Shadow were confused by the difference, they didn't show it. Both the pulp magazine and the radio show maintained their relative dominance of the field into the early 1940s. And if this Tale of Two Shadows was the first example of conflicting narratives for a hero in both print and media, it certainly wouldn't be the last. The Shadow's popularity spawned a variety of imitators, including the Phantom Detective, another playboy turned vigilante. But his significant other was an equally indelible character who glistened as brilliantly in the sunlight as the Shadow flourished in the drapes of darkness. Street and Smith sought another marketable title and ordered up an adventurer in the Soldier of Fortune mode. They brought in Lester Dent, a gifted pulp writer with a fondness for gadgets, to refine the idea. And in March 1933, Doc Savage, the Man of Bronze, hit the stands. If the Shadow played into the complicated scenarios of American vigilantism, Doc Savage was the American dream taken to an almost absurdly exponential degree. Clark Savage Jr. was heir to a mysterious fortune, derived from an unending supply of gold in the jungles of South America. He was raised to be perfect in almost every way. His 6'8" frame was covered with a bronze skin, deeply tanned by many tropical suns. His muscles, developed by a daily routine of calisthenics, were coiled like pythons. There was no physical feat beyond him, yet he was no clod-like muscle man. His daily regimen included mental logistics of calculus, and he spoke 24 languages. Doc carried an endless supply of gadgets, bombs, and miniature devices in his oft-ripped shirt or in his utility belt. He even had surgical skills of such magnitude that he could operate on the brains of captured criminals and turn them back to the path of the straight and narrow. He was no shadowy gunman either. Doc Savage made his headquarters in the center of Manhattan on the 86th floor of the world's tallest building. Clearly, the Empire State Building, implied, but never named. Anyone who was in trouble knew where to find him. Often trouble came directly to Doc and his companions, and did so 181 times, once a month, over the next two decades. Like most pulp scribes, Lester Dent had a house name imposed on his work, Kenneth Robeson, just in case he couldn't make his onerous deadlines. However, like Walter Gibson, he was devoted to his creation and kept at it for years without a replacement. His trick for banging out the stories was different than Gibson's. Dent simply stopped mid-sentence when he took a break and picked right back up. Dent also consolidated the idea of a team of adventurers that had proven effective since the serial escapades of the Three Musketeers. Doc was nearly always accompanied, sometimes claustrophobically so, by his Amazing Five, a band of spiritual brothers who each brought something necessary to the swashbuckling table. One was an ingenious chemist, one a master electrician, another a Harvard-educated lawyer to negotiate Doc's lease at the Empire State Building, one supposes. Nearly 200 adventurers gives a writer a good deal of narrative breadth. Dent added many original aspects to Doc's mythos, including an impenetrable fortress of solitude in the frigid wastelands of the Arctic, where the Man of Bronze would occasionally retreat to better prepare for the battle on behalf of mankind. It's not hard to discern the pulp's popularity. In addition to their inexpensive price point, they were reliable serial installments of hard-boiled adventures. The Shadow's violent and imperious escapades were the escapist complement to the explosion of gangland violence in the mid-1920s that continued into the 1930s. The Shadow was born into the same generation that deployed the Thompson submachine gun to such lethal effect, and his exploits overlapped with the imprisonment of Al Capone and the shooting of John Dillinger. As for Doc Savage's appeal, his biographer, Philip Jose Farmer, put it aptly. The average Depression-era citizen was feeling frustrated, anxiety-ridden, and diminished. But for 10 cents, he or she could be a superman, superwoman, in brain and body. The man who picked up a Doc Savage could become, for an hour, the wealthiest man in the world. Moreover, Doc could take his reader away from his grim world into the most exotic of places around the world. Although there were actually some skilled graphic illustrations within the pulps, they obviously appealed first to the reader, or at least to one who didn't mind the overbaked, often redundant prose. The real visual enticement of the pulps was their imaginative, colorful covers, which had to condense 100 pages of action into one spectacular image. Also impressive were the punchy, idiosyncratic logos that splashed across the top of the magazine. Given the way pulps were shelved on a newsstand, a logo had to be as recognizable as the character. The Shadow and Doc Savage had huge circulation numbers and inspired a host of imitators who would, in turn, be imitated in the comic book pages. There was the Spider, Master of Men, who embossed his criminal prey with a red spider on their foreheads, as well as the Black Bat, a blind district attorney who dressed up in a mask and bat wings to tackle predators. Their successors seem pretty obvious, but there was also the Avenger, probably the most imaginative of second-line pulp heroes, a millionaire who was so traumatized by his family's murder that his hair and skin turned chalk white. He was able to mold his anesthetized face into a variety of disguises, a neat trick if ever there was one. Still, lording over their progeny were the Master of Darkness and the Man of Bronze. The sheer number of their respective exploits was unprecedented. It was the first time since Sherlock Holmes that a popular heroic character could assemble both an extended biography as well as an apocrypha. Like many comic strip characters before them, they found success of sorts in other media, comic books, films, merchandise. Their fortunes in popular media were complementary. The Shadow had a major radio show, while Doc's never got out of the starting blocks. Likewise, Doc Savage had an astonishing revival in paperback reprints back in 1964, while the Shadow reprints didn't really catch on with the new generation. Still, both heroes cast long shadows, as it were. Doc Savage, born out of the action tradition, was indeed the modern Superman, a paragon of clean living and ethical philanthropy, who stood proudly in the sunlight of America's metropolis to right wrongs. The Shadow, showcased in a detective magazine, was more of a morally ambivalent nocturnal do-gooder who haunted the darker corridors of the American character and the urban landscape. The chiseled metallic adventurer and the caped paladin of darkness would be the twin lodestars of the Pulp Fiction universe. All in color for a dime. The early days of comic books. The comic book has been with us so long and seems like such an ideal package of art and adventure that it's hard to imagine what a long struggle there was for it to discover its perfect form. Popular comic strips had been anthologized in various book forms as far back as the beginning of the 20th century, but these were usually one-off experiments used for promotional purposes. By all accounts, the first real stab at a comic book came out right before the Depression hit. George T. Delacourt, Jr., chief of the Dell Publishing Company, exploited the popularity of the tabloid-sized Sunday funny papers by putting out a magazine called, understandably, The Funnies. It featured original cartoon material, one feature per page, in a publication the same size as the Sunday tabloid paper. It cost a dime and was published every week. This first attempt at a comic book wasn't a success, however. The Funnies lasted only 6 months, a victim perhaps of too much new stuff, too soon, and too different at a time when everyone was hunkering down, exploring their options as the Depression grew. The next attempt at a comic book came in 1933, the brainchild of Harry Wildenberg, who ran a concern out of New York called Eastern Color Printing. As a way of helping commercial companies to promote their products, he came up with Funnies on Parade, a giveaway item that reprinted a bunch of minor comic strips in color. To the surprise of Wildenberg and his colleague M.C. Charles Gaines, their print run went clean. Although distributors were skeptical that kids would buy reprints of strips they had already read, and presumably discarded, Eastern Color moved forward by putting out a book of strips called Famous Funnies No. 1 in 1934 and charging a dime a copy. It took a while to get off the ground, but within a few months, Eastern was making a nice profit with its 68-page funny books. Part of the genius of Famous Funnies was Eastern's way of repurposing strips so that they would fit within a smaller format, half a tabloid page, turned sideways, and stapled in the middle. It is still, more or less, the dimensional format of comic books that is used today. George Delacourt was impressed enough to take another bite at the apple. In 1936, he turned to Gaines, now allied with the McClure newspaper syndicate, to use his color printing presses to put out a new set of comic books. Dell's Popular Comics upped the ante by licensing previously published Sunday pages, featuring more high-profile characters, such as Dick Tracy. It wasn't long before the syndicates realized they might do better by putting out their own comic reprints, rather than leasing them to Delacourt or to anyone else. And so, by the beginning of 1937, eager readers with 10 cents to spare could catch up on the adventures of Popeye and Flash Gordon in King Comics, Lil Abner and Hal Foster's Tarzan in Tip Top Comics, published by United Feature Syndicate, which owned the characters, or Little Orphan Annie and Dick Tracy, reclaimed by the Chicago Tribune New York News Syndicate in Super Comics. Even with all this activity, there was still a piece or two missing from the puzzle. The comics were reprints and mostly featured humor strips. Combining this new visual medium with the slam-bang storytelling of the popular pulp adventure magazine would be the final game-changing element. The quixotic visionary of this evolutionary step was a former U.S. cavalry officer named Major Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson. Wheeler Nicholson had written tales of blood and thunder derring do for various pulps, but his innovation was to come up with a series of more adventure-oriented comic books inspired by the pulp genres, but with original stories. His first undercapitalized venture was New Fun Comics in 1935, which featured a more mature collection of original strips, albeit in black and white and in a tabloid size. The Major managed to turn out 6 issues of New Fun before it went bust, and he was only able to make it that far by paying younger, inexperienced artists and writers $6 per page, one of the lowest rates offered, for their derivative detectives and daredevils. Wheeler Nicholson might have vanished from history, along with the entire concept of comic book superheroes, had he not persevered after the failure of New Fun and sought out additional funding from Independent News Company, a magazine publisher and distributor. The company was created in 1932 by Harry Donenfeld and Jack Leibowitz, both children of Eastern European Jewish immigrants who grew up in New York's rough-and-tumble Lower East Side. They made an unlikely, if complementary and formidable, team. Donenfeld was a gregarious risk-taker with connections to the mob. Leibowitz was a socially conscious bookkeeper with an abacus for a brain and a sense of restraint. Donenfeld had built his business with a series of spicy pulp magazines, spicy detective stories, spicy Western stories, and so on, near pornography, or, at the very least, near pornography grafted onto detective and Western stories. Under the crusading banner of the newly elected mayor of New York City, Fiorello LaGuardia, local moralists took a dim view of Donenfeld's brand of publishing appearing on the city's newsstands and in its candy stores. In order to turn the tide, and in some measure to inoculate their distribution business against any kind of boycott on the shelves, the independent news company began to explore the lucrative and seemingly innocent world of comic books. Major Nicholson Wheeler's failed experiments offered independent news a slightly dilapidated room on the ground floor. Independent news put up the funding for Nicholson Wheeler's next two ventures, More Fun Comics and New Comics, under the condition that the publications come out in color and in the newer, more compact size. New Comics transformed into New Adventure, filled with various new adventure stories, again featuring the usual swashbucklers, big game hunters, and G-men. As 1936 came to a close, Wheeler Nicholson became convinced that the comic books could succeed by becoming more like the pulps, that is to say, longer stories for more mature readers set in various genres. With the backing of Donenfeld and Leibowitz, he launched Detective Comics, which would have been the first detective comic book to hit the market at Christmas time 1936, had the major been able to cough up enough money to pay the printing bills. It was beaten to the bare-knuckle punch by Detective Picture Stories, published at the end of the year. The major finally found the money to pay the printers, and in early 1937, cover date March, Detective Comics No. 1 finally hit the stands. Like most comic books, indeed, like nearly all comic books over the next decade, it was an omnibus of different stories varying from 4 to 8 to 13 pages each in length, in this case featuring an anthology of detective and mystery-oriented types. Even though Wheeler Nicholson had written a story or two for the book, the premier issue of Detective Comics was also his last. The major had defaulted on some of his payments, so Donenfeld bought him out to settle his debts. Donenfeld and Leibowitz also subsumed the name of the comic book's title as the larger banner for their new showcase imprint, Detective Comics Incorporated. Would the major have held out longer if he knew what was beyond the horizon? It's doubtful. He was seriously in debt, and, as much as he knew about life in the army, he knew practically nothing about the New York publishing racket and its various snares and stratagems. Donenfeld and Leibowitz also probably had very little prescience about what lay in store. All they knew was that they had acquired a couple of good platforms with which to launch a potential, profitable business, their life raft to get them out of the sinkhole of dubious pornography. As to what kind of stories would unfurl out of the comic books they now owned, that was for other, more imaginative folks to decide. Destined to reshape the destiny of a world. Siegel and Shuster. Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster met the way hundreds of kids had done before, and because of the dreams they shared, the way millions of kids would bond ever after. Siegel and Shuster were paradigms of geek culture decades before the term was invented, a term invented largely because of their greatest creation. They were both teenagers, working through their adolescence in a Jewish section of Cleveland. Neither boy ran with the popular crowd. Although the bespectacled Jerry loved writing and literature, he wasn't particularly assiduous as a student and would have to attend summer school. He wasn't an athlete and couldn't compete for the girls. Joe Shuster was slight and small. A loner by nature, he loved to draw and covered butcher paper and wallpaper with sketches from his own imagination. Jerry and Joe grew up on the fringes of poverty, made even more precarious by the advent of the Depression. There wasn't much money to spend on indulgences. Schuster lived in an apartment, Siegel in a small house. Their fathers were, as was typical for Jewish breadwinners, in the tailoring business, and their families had to make do with what little was brought home. The boys spent lonely evenings among uncommunicative families. During the day at school, surrounded by their more ebullient classmates, they were probably even lonelier. Poor Siegel had it even worse. In 1932, when he was 11, his father died suddenly, either shot during a robbery at his tailor shop or dropping dead from the shock. Newspaper accounts are unclear. Siegel and Schuster met at Glenville High for the first time in their early teens, when Schuster transferred from a school in his native Toronto. They lived 9.5 blocks away from each other and hit it off immediately through their shared love for popular heroic fiction and cartoon strips. Siegel had written a high school newspaper parody of Tarzan, and Schuster adored the cartoon shorts featuring the antics of Popeye. The Adventures of Silent Film Star Douglas Fairbanks was a particular favorite of both boys. His derring-do in various features where he played Zorro or D'Artagnan were always pulled off with the grinning panache of unerring confidence, something neither boy had much of. Siegel was the more entrepreneurial of the two, and, like many high schoolers, their friendship was formed when Siegel opened up his more sophisticated fantasy world to his friend. Siegel, enamored with space adventure pulps, produced his own in-house science fiction fan magazine, Cosmic Stories, on the school's crude mimeograph machines, and wrote all of the articles himself using a raft of pseudonyms. He had a grand vision for its national dissemination, beginning with mail subscriptions. He even acquired some fans in the bargain. Had Jerry Siegel grown up in the internet age, he'd be the first on his block to have a science fiction blog. As it was, he quickly enlisted his new pal to do some illustrations for a second fanzine, Science Fiction, and they were up, up, and away. For the January 1933 issue of their fanzine, Jerry had the idea of a longer story about a mad scientist who endows a homeless man with incredible strength and the ability to read minds. Joe illustrated the front piece. The Superman becomes corrupt, and the story concludes in a welter of ethically confused endings. They decided to revise their character, now known as the Superman, into a plainclothes hero, and showcased him in a larger illustrated story, an early comic book. Later that year, Siegel, who had the courage of his restrictions, mailed it out to an embryonic comic book publisher, but it was rejected. Schuster was so deflated by the bad news that he destroyed nearly all of the artwork. Perhaps the idea was too overblown and underbaked at the same time. There was even a crisis of faith on Siegel's part when he tried enlisting a professional cartoonist, the fellow who drew Buck Rogers, to reimagine Superman on the printed page, but nothing came of it. In the meantime, the boys graduated from high school but kept in touch, tossing one idea after another back and forth, filching different elements of popular culture and stitching them together like dime store Dr. Frankenstein's. There were strips about robots and G-men and two-fisted soldiers of fortune and far-off planets. It was all in good fun when one was supplying the kids in high school with such yarns, but by 1934, Siegel and Schuster were working odd jobs and living in their parents' homes. Then one sweltering summer night in 1934, according to a 1978 interview, Siegel was tossing and turning in his attic bedroom. When all of a sudden it hits me, I conceive of a character like Samson, Hercules, and all the strong men I ever heard of rolled into one, only more so. Working furiously through the night, Siegel jotted down a scenario on scraps of paper. As soon as the sun came up, he jogged over to Schuster's folks' apartment and laid out the idea. A Superman! Only this time, an unalloyed hero, and with a colorful costume at a Flash Gordon or the circus, just to prove he meant business. Such a magnificent creation deserved only the best showcase, right next to every kid's cornflakes at the morning breakfast table. Schuster began to send out Superman to every comic strip syndicate he could think of. Siegel and Shuster were met with rejection after rejection from 1935 through 1937. Too ridiculous. Come back when you're better. The Bell Syndicate supposedly wrote back, "We are in the market only for strips likely to have the most extraordinary appeal, and we do not feel that Superman gets into that category." M.C. Gaines, at the McClure Syndicate, considered a kind of visionary of the comic book form, offered no encouragement either. While Superman may have been the top of the line in the Siegel and Shuster portfolio, it was not their only creation. Although the high-toned comic strip syndicates weren't interested in their work, the early comic books were happy enough to fill their pages with heroes and adventurers created by two avid kids right out of high school. Before he went bust, Major Wheeler Nicholson hired them to create some backup features for his various fun titles, including Dr. Occult, probably comic's first supernatural hero, and a series of G-Men escapades. The Major sent them his usual stinting fee of $6 per page. Still, Siegel and Shuster were being published, admittedly under awkward noms de plume. Toiling away in Cleveland, nourished by tuna fish sandwiches prepared by their mothers, the boys were living the dream. The tarnish on that dream, however, was still the stacks of Bristol Board submissions of Superman that lay collecting dust in syndicate filing cabinets in New York and Chicago. It was the embryonic field of comic books that came to the rescue of their comic strip. In fall 1937, Detective Comics, Inc. was looking to launch another of the genre books to complement their newly acquired detective anthology. The pressure from Donenfeld and Leibowitz to get an action-oriented book on the stands was so intense that the managing editor, Vin Sullivan, had to pull from a backlog of rejected and second-rate submissions. There were the reliable, if uninspired, Soldiers of Fortune, Five-Star Reporters, and modern-day Buccaneers. The closest thing to an exciting hero was Zatara, Master Magician, a Mandrake ripoff who wasn't fooling anyone. Superman. Even though he didn't really fly for his first 4 years in print, Superman took off like no other character in popular culture. In his debut story in Action Comics No. 1, readers are given all they need to know about Superman's background in a cobbled one-page origin story. Superman was an infant son launched to Earth by his scientist father from a distant planet destroyed by old age. When he reached maturity, he discovered he had titanic strength that he could channel to benefit mankind and became Superman, champion of the oppressed, devoted to helping those in need. The first panel of his exploits has him literally jumping into the fray, the result, perhaps, of the quick cut-and-paste job performed in Cleveland in order to make a deadline. Then in the course of the next 12 pages, Superman saves an innocent woman from getting fried in the electric chair, implicates the true murderess, serves a wife-beater his just desserts, rescues Lois Lane from the amorous clutches of a mobster, breaks up the mobster's gang, and coerces a confession out of a crooked lobbyist. As Clark Kent, he also manages to put in a day at the office and set up a disastrous date with Lois Lane in the evening. It was, as historian Bradford Wright put it, a very busy first day on the superhero job. Superman was the first among not quite equals. The Shadow fought crooks who sought to undermine society, but not in broad daylight and not so colorfully. Flash Gordon had a strong jawline and colorful get-ups, but he performed his derring-do far away on another planet. Popeye was impossibly strong, but no one other than Olive Oil would have fallen for him. Doc Savage held up an impressive ethical value system for righting wrongs, but if he ever cracked a good joke, it went unrecorded. "People were waiting for this character to come along," said artist Jim Steranko. "He was a very appealing individual. He could essentially fly. Bullets would bounce off his chest. He could bend automobile bumpers into pretzels without even being winded. And he had this beautiful basic-colored outfit. Red, yellow, blue." Yet for all of his appeal, it was a while before Superman's publishers harnessed his considerable strength. He was, essentially, the lead feature, 13 pages per issue, in Action Comics, sharing the 64 pages with far duller action-oriented characters. For nearly 20 issues, he alternated cover space with car crashes, boat crashes, even French Foreign Legionnaires. As more and more children demanded Superman on the front cover, Detective Comics gradually obliged. Legends persist that publisher Harry Donenfeld was embarrassed by the costume character, but the truth is that, in the days before immediate sales reports, it took the publisher months to gin up the Superman engines. Still, only a year after his debut, Superman was given his own book, which devoted all 64 pages to the exclusive exploits of the Man of Tomorrow, as he was dubbed by his publisher. Another first for a comic book hero. Superman's initial exploits indeed centered around being a friend of the helpless and oppressed. He went after racketeers, corrupt munitions dealers, unscrupulous mine owners, and hoodlums muscling in on circuses. In one story, he even extorts various criminals in order to raise $2 million to save an orphanage. His frequent retort to malefactors was, "We'll see about that." Superman didn't solve mysteries or go out on nocturnal patrols. He saved things. And in so doing, he found a receptive audience. Jules Pfeiffer puts it into context. Superman came at a time when, as many people saw it, particularly Jews, a superhero in a wheelchair had entered the White House, and that was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The notion that you could have a superhero who was going to stand up for you, who would be your advocate, was connected to the hope brought on by this larger-than-life figure in the White House. Crippled though he was, FDR had this secret identity, taking off into outer space and solving problems with the New Deal, and creating a whole new feeling with the New Deal. Superman was an underground New Dealer. Superman's powers increased incrementally, as did the dramatic power of his existence. He could hurdle over 20-story buildings, lift tremendous weights, was impervious to bullets, had astonishing hearing and eyesight. Although he could jump and leap like a grasshopper on steroids, and often appeared swooping down on things, Superman was not given the full power of flight and the comic book continuity until October 1943. His radio program, out of necessity, conveyed that gift as early as 1940. Gradually, he gained his X-ray vision and adversaries worthy of his overpowering might. The first of the latter was the Ultra-Humanite, a bald, wheelchair-bound mad scientist who appeared hygienically challenged. His vocation as Superman's archenemy was ceded to the ingenious, nefarious, and eventually bald as well, Lex Luthor by 1941. Superman's early stories didn't even exploit the drama of his transformation into Superman. He is often shown in a modestly decorated apartment, putting his feet up on the bed while changing into his costume. He could well be going out for a jog. Even his S insignia took a while to develop dimension and plasticity. Its early manifestations look like a poor man's Kiwanis Club badge, and sometimes it appears on the back of his cape, sometimes not. Part of Superman's appeal was his good looks. As writer Denny O'Neill phrased it, it was kind of comforting when people realized that although he was a very nearly omnipotent creature, he is straight from the Chamber of Commerce, or the land in which Norman Rockwell paintings exist. And yet, Superman wasn't from the Midwest. At least not initially. He was from another planet. This was one of Jerry Siegel's many twists on science fiction tropes, and in a seminal way, perhaps his most effective. Previous heroic characters such as Flash Gordon were all Americans who were spirited away to other planets to fight alien races. Superman was himself of an alien race, whose destiny was to be with us. Author Michael Chabon delves into the mythic and cultural ramifications of this journey.
Superman, his name's Kal-El. You know, it's like a Hebrew. It sounds like Hebrew. I think if you translate it into Hebrew, you could have it say that it means like the voice of God or something like that. So, you know, he comes from this other place. He comes from Krypton. He immigrated to Earth. He left everything behind. That world is gone. He comes here. He changes his name to something that sounds, you know, really Gentile, Clark Kent. It's absurdly Gentile sounding. And, you know, he takes on this persona of all American guy. And so, you know, there's a, there's an allegory, or maybe it's just a kind of an intentional metaphor for the American immigrant experience, not just the Jewish experience, but the changing of the name, the,